Hello, listeners.
Hello, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life. And boy, what was that?
That was the intro to our episode for this very special game that we are discussing today, Matthew.
I mean, I can't say that you're overplaying it too much because it does quite sell itself as such.
Matthew, can you tell the listeners what game, or better yet, can you mentally link with the listeners so that they will just know what game we are talking about today?
I will mentally link them by sending electronic pulses through sound waves.
You're just gonna tell them.
Yes, we are talking about The Mind, and about The Mind, if you think about it. Designed by Wolfgang Warsch and published in 2018 by NBV, which has a longer name that I'm not going to try to pronounce because I would butcher it. And it was nominated for Spiel, nominated for Trick Track Door, nominated for Origins Best Card Game, and it was nominated for and won a ton of Golden Geek categories for 2018. Awesome. So this is a pretty
lauded game from last year. So to give a short description of what The Mind is all about, in The Mind, players must link their consciousnesses in order to complete one unified goal, to play the cards in their collective hands in ascending order from lowest to highest, starting at 1 and going all the way up to 100, without going out of order. In round 1, each player is dealt one card, then after a brief linking ritual, play begins. Every round afterwards adds a card to the player's hands. As a team, you share a number of lives. Whenever a card is played out of order, you lose a life. You have a tool that can help you in your efforts called the Throwing Star. And if every player unanimously agrees to use their Throwing Star by raising their hand silently, then every player plays their lowest numbered card. The game ends either when you run out of lives as a team or when you reach a certain level, depending on how many players you have. At 2 players, it is level 12, which is the highest level in the game. At 3 players, that is level 10. And at 4 players, that is level 8. And that is the gist of how you play The Mind.
Well, there is one huge, humongous catch I don't think you mentioned.
Oh, of course. The biggest thing. Yeah. The most important thing. That you cannot communicate with your other players during the game.
Right. Well,
you cannot communicate to them. To be more specific, you can't communicate what cards you have in any way to your allies, not by talking, not by any nonverbal cues.
Right.
You can't let them know in any way what cards you have.
Right. By extension, you can't let them know who should play first or whether you're just waiting. Any info about the cards in your hand is info about the cards in your hand.
Right. And any planning to develop some sort of method of communication or tell or any kind of like just any method in general, not even of communicating, but like how you could play the game is not permitted in this game.
It's cheating and it's illegal.
It's cheating, and what's the fun in that?
Yeah,
it's you versus the game, and of who's going to stop you from cheating against the game? Yourself, that's who. So get some resolve and show some respect to The Mind.
But I trust our viewers, and I mean our listeners wouldn't cheat.
Yeah, so we're going to get a little bit more into the gameplay now in this next portion, and this portion is going to be interesting because we call this portion the strategy portion in all of our other episodes, but you can't truly have a strategy coming into this game, at least agreed upon amongst the other players. You can't discuss your strategy beforehand,
right?
Or in the middle of the game.
You can have a personal strategy.
And that's sort of what we're going to talk about, I think, is we're going to talk about personal strategy, and we're going to give some tips on how you can play this game and do well at it.
Yeah.
So the most important thing in this game is being able to read your allies, being able to read the other players, and being able to understand how they pause, how they wait, and how long they wait for certain reasons.
Yeah. So to take it a step back, So okay. The cards are all 1 to 100. There's 100 cards. And yeah. So you could think of it as, like, if somebody had a 1, they would be immediately slamming it on the table from their hand.
Right. And if then, somebody had a 2, they would slam it almost as quickly as a 1. Probably yeah. just as quickly as a 1.
Yeah. And you can extrapolate that further. A 9 might be pretty quick then, but mm-hmm. a 20, they would probably wait a little bit just in case there was a 10 or whatever. And so yeah. by this, you can kind of map out how everybody will approach the game with a clock, where it's like, you know, this is how long I'll wait before I play this increment.
Right. And after somebody plays another card, then that clock kind of resets and you yeah. go by the same logic. You know, if somebody had the very next card, they'd slam it down. If somebody yeah. had a card that was 2 away, they would probably play it pretty quickly. And then the longer players wait, the further away the cards that they have in their hand are from the card that was just played.
Yeah.
But that waiting period is different for everybody. So
and you can't tell what yours is.
Yeah, you can't explain what yours is, or you can't develop a system. So like for example, you can't just say everyone count in your heads, you know, with the clock. If you had like a clock, just like every second count one number, and if you have that number, put it down, and because that would just be cheating. That'd yeah. be no fun. So you have to kind of figure out what everyone's clock is like. You figure that out by playing this game over and over again.
Right. This is a game you're not supposed to win the first time or the second time or maybe even the third time.
Maybe not that you're not supposed to win, but that you're probably not going to win.
Yeah.
So when you're playing this game and as you're playing it, as you fail, you just kind of start to get an idea of how long everybody likes to wait before they play a card that's a certain number above the previous card.
Yeah. Another big thing I've kind of paid attention to is posture. Mm-hmm. So you can think of, like, if somebody's like really eager to play a card, like they're bending over, maybe that card is closer to what's currently on the board.
Yeah, maybe they're kind of pulling a card out of their hand and kind of setting it up to lay it down.
Yeah.
Now, all of those things are tells, kind of like in poker. And it's okay in this game as long as it's they're not doing it on purpose.
Yeah.
It's unintentional. If they're unintentionally doing these things like sitting forward and pulling a card and kind of playing with one of their cards because they feel like they're about to play it, or even midway through putting a card down and then pulling it back for a moment of hesitation, these are all tells that are fine to read on in this game as long as you're not explicitly doing them, or
yeah, you know,
as long as it's not explicit. Yeah. Or
I think a good way to put it is, don't worry about what you're doing, worry about what everyone else is doing. That way, like, you're not even thinking about how your posture is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of
right. I don't believe it says in the rule book that you have to try to be stone-faced,
yeah,
and completely still. They don't ban you from doing these sorts of things, but of course you shouldn't do them on purpose. Like if you have a card that's maybe 7 away from the last played card, and so you're kind of waiting for somebody else to play something that's closer, something that's 6 or less away from the previous card. But you also don't want to show that you're waiting too long because you have a card that's way higher. You can't on purpose pull the card out and hover, you know, a little yeah. bit. As if to say, I think I'm going to play the next card unless you think you have a more urgent card.
Right. I will say, though, to be fair, that ties into the biggest source of, like, uncertainty, which is your low card really that low? Is your high yeah. card really that high? Because, you know, for, say, say 30, there's a good chance that a 30 would be the lowest card dealt in, like, the first 3 rounds. Because it's, you know, 30% of the cards are below it, 70% is higher. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, it could be reasonable to think, I'm dealt a 30, you know, maybe nobody else has one before it, I'll play it, you know, after a bit. But the person with the 20 might also think, you know, maybe somebody has something lower than a 20. And the idea is that, like, any sort of relative difference of whether or not you have a card that's higher or lower or whatever is hard to really know for certain whether or not you actually have the better card to play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you can have a 19 and a 20 in the same game.
Sure.
So, like,
I mean, at some point it can be unlucky, but
yeah,
the difference between a 20 and a 30 is a difference that can actually, you know, be understood in a session of the mind, not necessarily in one game, but maybe after three or four games, you might actually be able to come to some sort of understanding with everybody else you're playing with, implicitly, that, you know, waiting a certain amount of time means that you can play a 20 and feel safe about
yeah.
it. And then a different amount of time, a longer amount of time, would mean that now it's time to play a 30 because nobody's played anything.
Yeah.
Now, there's a tool that you're given that can help with these sort of large gaps. And that is the
throwing star.
So we mentioned this in the short description, but to go over it again, everybody just has to unanimously agree to use a throwing star. It's a limited resource. You start with one at the beginning of the game. And if you use it, then it's gone for the rest of the game. But if you finish certain rounds, you will get more throwing stars back. So once everyone unanimously agrees to use the throwing star, everybody puts out their lowest card in their hand, and then play resumes from there. And if you had something that fits in between all those cards, you can play it then, but you have to make sure that those are in order now.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of nuances to using throwing stars in this game.
I was going to say, first of all, it should be mentioned that you also do get extra lives as you pass certain rounds.
Right.
I don't know if we clarified that with the throwing stars or not, but yeah.
I believe at the end of rounds 2 and 3, and then 5 and 6, and then 8 and 9 are the rounds that you get more throwing stars in lives. It goes a throwing star on 2, life on 3, throwing star on 5, life on 6, and so on. So using a throwing star. So usually everyone will agree to use a throwing star when there is a big gap in the cards and everyone else's cards, either there's just such a huge gap that you can't really be sure, no matter how long you wait, whether your card is the lowest amongst everyone else's, or possibly even that your card and a couple other cards are really close together, so nobody knows exactly when to play their specific card. And again, that's also tied to there being a large gap. Usually if there's a pretty narrow gap, like cards are within 20, 25 of the previously played card, players will feel comfortable playing those cards after a long enough time period.
Right.
So the gap, and then using this throwing star, you're using this throwing star usually when like the next lowest card is probably like 30 or more away from the previously played card. But if you have, like, to use an example of what the throwing star could mean in a situation, say you have a card that's like 30 away, maybe you even have the 30 and nobody's played a card yet. And then everybody else in the game requests to use the throwing star. So it comes down to your vote. You could say, okay, let's play a throwing star. I'll play my 30. You guys play whatever you have and we'll see what happened. But you might be comfortable enough with everybody throwing their hands up to say like, oh, they probably have very high cards right now. I think the 30 is probably actually pretty low comparatively. So I'm just going to play that instead. So when a throwing star vote occurs, that doesn't mean that you can't play your cards. It doesn't mean you have to like wait for the vote to pass or fail. You could just cut off the vote and say like, no, actually I do have a low enough card here.
Right. Now, it should be mentioned that there is still a lot you can learn when you play a throwing star, because since everybody's playing their lowest card, you know that, like, if somebody plays a 60 from a throwing star, then any cards below 60, you don't have to worry about them having.
Right.
This comes into play with, like, how you can play cards that are between the lowest number and the highest number played on the throwing star, because, you know, one person might not have anything lower than a 60, but somebody might have like a 29 and then a 40. And so like, you know, the person with that plays their 29, and then they know that the person who played the 60 isn't going to have anything, you know, before the 40.
Mm-hmm.
So now, it kind of helps you kind of figure things out.
It lets you eliminate some possibilities from
yeah.
some of the players.
Yeah.
which can help. Now, I will say that after a throwing star gets played, players can kind of go into a frenzy because, you know, even after that's played, like somebody could play it. Say you use a throwing star, somebody plays a 20, somebody plays a 40, and somebody plays an 80. You know, somebody with a 42 might say like, oh, I can play the 42 now because there's the 40. But somebody else might have like a 25. The person with a 20 might have like a 25 in their hand. So then they would have to play the 25 first before the other player plays the 40. But because their 42 is so close to the 40, they might be inclined to play it very quickly.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of the case usually when you have something that's very close to the previous card, you throw it down quickly. So you have to kind of reset and play slowly after a throwing star is used, just to be sure that like the lowest card you're starting from there and not from the cards in the middle or the card at the very end.
I would almost say like just set them on the table so that after everyone's played the throwing star cards, that the lowest one is the only one visible of those.
Yeah. I like to just kind of start a second pile with the throwing star cards.
Yeah.
Now, there's another slightly other way of conferring information to other players. And that's just by proposing to use the throwing star, because that kind of says,
I'm unsure.
I have a high card. I'm unsure if it's the next lowest card. I don't think it is, but it could be. I think we should use a throwing star. There's been a couple times when I've initiated a throwing star vote and it passed, and then we played our cards and I had the lowest card anyways. And in those cases, I mean, I think it's good that we use the throwing star there, because I had such a high card that I was probably willing to wait for somebody else who wasn't willing to wait to play it. And that would have just lost a life. Mm-hmm. It's important to note that a throwing star is kind of like a bonus life in this game.
Yeah.
Because it or multiple bonus. Well, I guess just one bonus life, because it essentially everyone play a card out of order, except one player.
Yeah. I would almost say it's a life and a half. If we're going to get technical, because a life is hard to get everybody to get a card from. Mm-hmm. Because like if multiple people have a card that's played out of order. So like if player A plays a 40 and player B and C both have cards lower than a 40, higher than the previous card, you would only lose one life still.
Yeah.
So like, whereas a throwing star, you're always going to get a card from every player.
Sure. So yeah, it's kind of like a life and a half, but it's something that you have to use, you know, you have to initiate the vote. You have to use it yourself.
Yeah.
Which means that if you just play the game and you lose all your lives without using any of your throwing stars, then that's kind of like leaving money on the table. That's not that you didn't you had four lives to lose and you lost after losing three, which was bad.
Yeah.
Don't hesitate to use throwing stars, probably especially when you're down to a low count of lives, like when you're down to your last one or two lives, it's best to start throwing out those throwing stars.
Yeah.
To hang in there for another life.
Yeah. By the way, we forgot to mention a rule in the rule book that isn't really relevant to the mechanics of the game, which is that the game has rules for linking your minds at the start of the game.
And during the game.
Right.
So the gist of it is that before play begins,
in a round,
after you've dealt cards to everybody, everyone has to link their minds. And you do that by, I mean, first you get to look at your hand that you've been dealt. You get to organize the cards so you can put it in lowest to highest order so they're ready to go. And then everybody places a palm on the table. And once everybody has their palm on the table, then that means that you have linked your minds and you can pick your palms up and begin play. Now, also, if at any time during a round you feel like your lines have got your minds have gotten disconnected, you can link them again by saying stop. It's like the only word you're allowed to say during the game. You say stop, and then everybody puts their palms on the table once more in a pause just to relink their minds.
Right. So when we talked about stopping after you play a throwing star, this is something you can do for that.
Sure. You know, it might even be beneficial. This is something we didn't really take into consideration. It might actually be a little beneficial that after a super long pause to just stop, because there's and actually, I'll throw this out too. There's times when the pause can go for so long that you kind of lose focus yourself.
Yeah, it gets kind of crazy.
It's weird. I had a moment when we were playing where, because normally when we play, I'm thinking out loud in my head, or not out loud, I'm thinking in my head to myself, like, okay, if this person had a card that started with a 2, like 20 to 29, they would have played it by now. So now I'm safe to play my 31. I say that like in my head as we're playing. But in some cases, when the pauses can go for too long, it just that thought process gets lost somewhere. I'm just like, wait, has it been long enough that they should have played a 30 by now? 50 yet? Maybe they have a 40. Has it been long enough for that? I can't remember. I kind of got distracted a little bit. So in those times, it's probably okay just to stop it.
It's
beneficial to stop it.
This is like a wellness technique, just like, you know, meditation almost.
Yeah.
Which is funny that it kind of encourages that. Mm-hmm. I will say I have one more strategy point.
Okay,
me too. Which is that another important thing, not just to think about how the other players are pacing, or they're like looking at the time or thinking of the time or whatever, figure out how much each player, like what range each player considers to be low. So I mean this, like, we played with one guy in a 3-player game, and it seemed like we all kind of took under 30 to be pretty safe to play early on, and then we played with our parents last night, and it seemed like they were hesitant to play anything under 10 that early. So, like, getting an idea of what people think is low or is, like, safe to play at the start helps you contextualize when those timers are starting for everybody.
Right.
Because if somebody thinks that, you know, a 21 is unsure, then they might be waiting for a long time, and you might think they have, like, a 40 or 50 or something if they're waiting that long. So yeah,
right. And these comfort zones are, you know, they're tied to the whole, like, player clock, a player's internal clock.
Exactly.
Like how long they believe they should wait for different increments of numbers.
Yeah.
So yeah, totally agree. To pay attention to that kind of thing. The last point that I wanted to make about this game is that you will play a lot and you will lose a lot. But in, like, intentionally playing a card out of order after a very long time has passed, or just losing in general, is a tool in this game, because it's the only way to really develop that understanding of how the other players are playing the game and how long they're willing to wait for different numbers is by finding the edges of those cases.
Yeah,
there's times, like, it's been in the first, like, two or three playthroughs of this game where I will have a very high card and people are waiting for a very long time, in my opinion, and I will kind of condition them to say, if we wait this long again, then I won't hesitate to play a card that's like 50 more than the previous card we played, because that's how I'm interpreting this time. And, you know, after a while it might be that, like, they'll be a little more inclined to play their cards sooner, which is good, but then that might get to a point where they're playing them too soon. So we just find this balance through all that of, like, how fast you need to react and how long you should wait. And if things are getting to a point where you just can't understand it, or things are wrong, then it's okay to mess up and just restart.
Yeah. Don't be afraid of failure, because you can learn from it.
Yeah, and especially don't be afraid of failure, because this game is all about failing and trying again.
Yeah.
So at that, let's get into the design.
Yeah, that discussion. Sounds like a good point to jump over.
Yeah. This game is all about failing and trying again. It's really not about winning.
Right. I compared this when I first played it to, like, a roguelite video game, or just like an arcade game where... Right. The game has a set endpoint, but it's designed so that you're not really, like, you're not meant to always get there the first time you play. It's much more about learning the tricks of the game, learning the patterns of the game, and seeing how far you can go with the end, like the ending of the game being sort of like a target, but also just, you know, it is just a timer, and it, how long you can last is still good. Mm-hmm. It contextualizes failure and victory as the same thing in that way, in that, like, this is just like the arcadey style where, like, even if you lose late into the run, it's still a personal best. Like, even if you lose on level 7 in this game, if you haven't gotten to level 7 before, then you did a great job. And it helps make those late losses a little better, that case.
And right. It's about surviving as long as you can.
Right.
Not necessarily about just reaching a certain point. And it's interesting how they put it in the rule book, because, I mean, the target goal for any team is different depending on how many people are playing. So, like, if you're playing with just two people, your target goal in the rule book is 12 rounds. If you're playing with four, the target goal is 8 rounds. But how that's kind of like a variable thing, and it's not tied to any sort of like grand conclusion, is kind of interesting, and that kind of softens that goal. It kind of makes that goal less important.
Yeah. And
it's also just about like surviving a number of rounds,
right?
In how the game is designed, not about like obtaining, like, it's not like after round 4 you get the key, and then after round 8 you get the lock, and then in the 4-player game you've won. Now that you've collected the key and the lock or whatever, it's just like you got that many rounds. Good job.
Yeah, it's almost like when you don't actually see the end point of the game for most of the game, you don't worry about not having reached that end point. Whereas, like, if you had collected half of a victory condition and then you lost, it would probably feel much worse.
I'm also kind of like
you're losing out on something.
There's, like, zero flavor to winning the game.
Right, yeah.
It's not like you've won, now you can... Now your minds are totally one. Take your minds are one card.
Yeah.
Congratulations. It's just like, oh, okay. Yeah. You went to round 8.
Yeah. I think it's telling that when we first got the game, and like up until yesterday, we didn't actually know how many rounds there were for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think we thought it was 13 for a bit, and then it turns out it was 12 for a 2-player game, but there's
fewer. Yeah. We didn't even really care
more players.
How far the game was supposed to be played too.
Yeah. I do want to say also the way the lives and the throwing stars are awarded to you is also very arcadey, video gamey. Mm-hmm. Like, just after reaching a certain level, then you get a bonus that offsets the increased difficulty slightly. And this does use the same concept in roguelites, which is that early game, like in the first few rounds, it's much better to try to hold on to your resources as long as possible for when you need them, so that it still awards skill and like skill progression. But like it makes it so that in general, like, you care more about the earlier levels early on in your skill curve, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So like when you're starting out the game, getting through level 1 and 2 without using a life or a throwing star is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't care as much usually about getting better or like getting through the rest of it, because you have a short-term goal to get better at, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So like it's not like having these rewards reduces the amount of skill or like the desire to get better. It's that it rewards getting better at like slower paces. Yeah.
I have that. I mean, the core mechanic is very simple, and there's not much to say about it, that you're just playing cards from 1 to 100.
Yeah.
And you're not talking.
It's very minimalist.
I was going to say that, but then I realized there's not a lot of games that forbid you from communicating with the other players, like at all times. So the only other game that I know of that does is Magic Maze. But even then, they give you that brief moment to actually discuss strategy when you flip the timer in that game.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm finding interesting about this is that it at first, that kind of a mechanic seems like a bad idea just to put in any game, because people like to talk. So if you're stopping them from talking while they attempt to do this very social in-person around the table thing, that seems just like a bad idea in general. That seems like you're asking for an unfun experience. But I mean, this game is, you know, it won so many awards. It was super popular last year. A lot of people were talking about it.
Yeah.
It kind of makes me think that like asking the players to not communicate is it's not bad. It's not a bad thing.
It's at least an untapped well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
I mean, Magic Maze also, everyone I've played Magic Maze with, everyone that has played Magic Maze that I've talked to has really enjoyed that game.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's another case of like, it's just something that people haven't really pushed to its limits so far. And now that we have some games that have done it and done it really well, I feel like more people will start to take the concept and work it into more genres, kind of like deck building was.
Mm-hmm.
Where like, you know, maybe now that we have these two games, more forbidden communication games will appear and it'll have its own board game geek category.
Maybe.
Maybe you can be
just,
the first one.
It's just interesting to me.
Yeah.
That it's like this counterintuitive thing that people actually find very fun.
Yeah. And I think if you look at both of these games, they sort of counteract the lack of communication in different ways. Magic Maze makes it so hectic that like you might as well be screaming over each other.
Well, Magic Maze is also a very simple game.
Right.
Not Magic Maze, sorry. The Mind is a very simple game.
Yeah.
Go back to Magic Maze.
Well, yeah, sorry. But with The Mind, and it's like the opposite. It's that it makes it so tense that like you almost don't want to talk because it would interrupt your train of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so by making these other things that are really intense and allow you to focus on them, it makes up for not allowing talking, because it's like, why would you talk anyways?
Yeah. So I was going to say that The Mind benefits from being a very simple game. To abandon all communication isn't super detrimental, just because you're not focusing on much in this game. The only thing you're focusing on is what number other players may have in their hand, and that's up to three other players that you're focusing on.
Right, and every mechanic stems from those. So, like, losing a life stems from people playing numbers.
Yeah, the rest of the mechanics, like whether or not you use a shuriken, I guess that is something that could maybe distract you. But that's your moment to actually communicate with other players. That's like your olive branch of communication. Yeah,
I think for me, sorry, I was gonna say, I think for me, it's more so that like you're focusing on the numbers like 99% of the game, and all the other mechanics are mechanics that you can choose to use while you're thinking about numbers.
Right, and the numbers go from 1 to 100, and they go up. So it doesn't take much mental fortitude to think about the numbers.
Yeah.
And then compare that to Magic Maze. Magic Maze is a little bit of a more complicated game, and so they give you more ways to communicate. They give you the option to talk when the timer gets flipped, and they also give you that little gavel that lets you kind of alert other players or communicate to them in some nonverbal way.
Right. You know, it's interesting when you say it like that. In Magic Maze, while your timer flips are still a limited resource, in The Mind, the main way to communicate, throwing stars, is a super limited resource. You start with only one, which is kind of cool that, like, the easy way to communicate with people is itself limited in game mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. What I'm getting at is just that the simplicity of the game determines how much leverage you can give the players with how they can communicate and how often they can communicate. The simpler the game, the more you can prohibit them from communicating.
Right.
And that's evidenced by just looking at this game, The Mind, and looking at Magic Maze. You see The Mind, it's a simple game. There's almost zero communication. You look at Magic Maze, it's a more complicated game. There's actually a lot more communication compared to The Mind.
Yeah. It's also that, like, with a more complicated rule set, it's harder for new players to play without, like, asking questions.
Sure.
You know, new players might be afraid to ask questions if talking isn't allowed, and it's a complicated game. So having a really simple idea of playing numbers from low to high in order, like, it's a pretty easy to understand mechanic. And outside of maybe, like, when you can play cards if somebody plays out of order, or how to initiate a throwing star vote, there's not many complicated portions.
Right.
So it's a bit more friendly that way. I did want to say that with the numbers being 1 to 100, it's really easy to get an idea, at least for some people, at least for me at least, of how many, of like the odds that there will be a card lower or higher.
Sure. Like it's, I mean, literally, it's literally percentage. A percentage, exactly. Yeah.
And so I think that's nice by having a number you can easily keep track of, being like, oh, there's literally 30% of cards that are 30 or below, you know. It makes the whole, like, judging odds of who has what in hand and what might be safe to play a lot easier to track, at least for me. And, you know, maybe that's, like, a different skill it allows. Instead of somebody who's good at reading other people, you're good at reading odds and numbers.
Sure.
And stuff like that. Since there's not really much mechanics, it does allow for that sort of personality type.
Sure. I guess the last thing that I want to talk about design wise is flavor of the game. Because I could bet this game would be a lot less interesting if it didn't have that extra little bit of flavor where you're like linking your minds and there's this whole like psychic port, this whole psychic edge to it.
Yeah.
And how there's that extra rule where you can ask to stop and put your palms on the table. Just the fact of putting your palm on the table, it's kind of like a seance.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, Just the fact that they added that into the game, even though it's not really mechanically important, sells the game for me. Yeah, makes it a lot more interesting than if it were just a game about not talking and putting cards on the table in order from 1 to 100.
Right. I think this is something that I brought up in the Betrayal Legacy Part 1 episode, which is that if you want your players to do something fun that isn't a mechanic, just put it in the rule book. It's like Inception, where, like, since the mind said, hey, why don't you put your palms on the table to link your mind? I was like, oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And if they had never said anything about that, I would never have thought to, like, try to take a deep breath before every round. You know,
that's also a funny point to bring up, that when we were playing, you know, we did the palms on the table to start the round, but we also decided that we would take a collective breath.
Yeah.
You know, we'd inhale, exhale, and then we'd begin play.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we probably wouldn't have done anything like that if the whole palm rule wasn't in the book to begin with.
Yeah,
we would have just picked up our cards and started playing.
Yeah,
it does help to say, like, okay, you get to organize your cards first before you start playing. Mechanically, that's important because it lets everyone look at their cards and realize, like, oh, I do have a one. It's not tucked away in their hand right when it's dealt to them.
Yeah.
They can put it at the front, set it down, and then immediately pick up their cards and play it once game starts because you have that pause.
Yeah.
But flavorfully, yeah, it also just adds that thing that makes the game actually a little more fun to play.
Right, yeah. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's like, I guess they didn't need to put it in there. It sets the tone, though, in the atmosphere. It's like, I do think it's fun that the game, like, really, really, like, sells itself as, like, this revolutionary thing. I think, you know, it's a game. It can be really fun, and it's kind of campy at first, but I think it adds to the experience.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to say it's interesting. It has this mascot that's, like, a rabbit.
Like, yeah, it's like a ninja rabbit.
Yeah, it reminds me of the movie The Last Mimsy, which had, like, psychic kids and a toy rabbit or something. I just thought that was a weird... I mean, I guess rabbits and magic are kind of linked together thematically. I just think that was a weird, like, mascot choice that kind of struck something with me.
The artwork in this game is a little weird. So the levels in this game depict, like, a rabbit going through, like, ninja training.
Yeah.
And the rabbit looks like Rayman.
Sort of.
But not like the rabbits from Rayman. Just like Rayman himself in rabbit form. It's weird.
No limbs.
Yeah, the artwork confuses me, I don't know. There's nothing else to say. It's just kind of weird.
Yeah, but it's fun.
But it's fun. The flavor is good.
It all wraps together in a good package.
It's a very simple game, but it's very fun to play. All the iterations, you get further and further. It's very satisfying to get like a new high score.
It's very fun to play this with different people too.
Yeah,
you know, the games that we played with a friend of ours were completely different than the games we played with our parents.
Right. And yeah, it's kind of fun to start from the beginning and feel out again how people's clocks run.
Yeah.
In this game.
Yeah.
All right. I don't have anything else to say about The Mind, and we mentioned Magic Maze. That's if you wanted to check out other games like The Mind, that's definitely where you should go next.
Yeah.
Or if you've played Magic Maze, then you might be interested in The Mind.
Yeah. And then there's all the other alternative communication games like Concept and Codenames.
Sure.
That we always like to recommend.
Those aren't quite like.
Yeah, they're not zero communication
games.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm interested to see more games like this in the future. So if you, first of all, thank you for listening to our episode on The Mind. Mm-hmm. If you would like, you can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we post all our episodes and we tag them with the games that we talked about. I believe we haven't done an episode on Magic Maze, but we did mention it in a Geekway recap episode somewhere in that stack of episodes that we've published. You can also find a link to our TeePublic store on our website. That's teepublic.com/user/bgbcast. It's where we have our t-shirts that have our cool logo on it. You can pick those up there. And that's it for BG Bros plugs. So let's go over to Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream on weekdays from 11 a.m. Central Time to about 2 or 3 p.m. Central Time. I stream a lot of roguelites, a lot of fighting games. I started playing a Mario World ROM hack called Jump Half. So if you read my article about Super Mario World ROM hacks, you might be interested in that. Speaking of which, I write articles on the Board Game Bros website. A lot of these are related to game design and stuff like that, mostly in video games, though. You can find them on the Episodes and Articles tab. My most recent one was on the game Enter the Gungeon and how the flavor and mechanics of the game coexist. And also through the Twitch page, I forgot to mention, but we have a Discord server for the Twitch stream, but you can use that to chat with us if you want. Talk about the podcast, talk about the stream, talk about games, etc.
All right, that does it for Matt Plugs, and that does it for me, and that does it for us at the BG Bros Podcast headquarters. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
We have a headquarters?